you. And if you don't come seat at the, you know, reasonable time, I get to keep the deposit. Just an idea. I'll pray about it first. I love to see your fellowship, so I hate to interrupt. But you don't want me speaking at 12:30, so. I hope you had a good week. I hope that you have tried to be mindful of God in all the things that you do throughout the week. Did anybody look up fun facts for Valentine's Day? I did. Most of them aren't that fun, but there are an average of 220,000 wedding proposals on Valentine's Day each year. Does anybody, I didn't even know that was that big a deal for that. Has anybody here got proposed to on Valentine's Day? For you single people, it's not too late. You can still go there if you want. It is a good time. We're not big holiday people, kind of, because we're busy, so I don't spend a lot of time preparing for these things. I wasn't up early getting ready for Valentine's Day. But it's good to be thankful for the people you love. Holidays can be a burden, but they can also be really kind of fun. We're not going to study Valentine's Day, though. We're going to get back into Matthew. Last week, we ended by looking at the faith of the Syrophoenician woman. And if you have the sheet in your hand, it's actually just slightly before that. So you'll just have to go with me as we look at it just for a second. We saw Jesus use this conversation with the Gentile woman to increase and confirm her faith, and also as a tool to bring into the mindset of the disciples that he was going to reach out to Gentiles, that the kingdom of heaven was not just going to be the exclusive property of the Jewish nation. It was going to be for all of his creation. Remember, when he chose Israel and gave them the law, it was for them to be an example to everyone of God's love for them and his care for them. Unfortunately, they didn't do that. Their religious tendencies made them very exclusive. They did not only not show love to the world, they didn't show the glory of God. They looked down on the world and refused to help them because they looked at the world as unclean. That's the end result of their religion. In 15 verses 29 through 31, we saw that Jesus departed from there and he went and sat down. It said, Jesus departed, skirted the Sea of Galilee, went up on the mountain and sat down, and the great multitudes came to him. They brought him the lame, the maimed, and many others, and they laid them down at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. So the multitude marveled when they saw the mute speaking and the maimed made whole and the lame walking and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. He had just went around the Sea of Galilee. He'd gone up into the Gentile area and he went up there to get away and prepare. Now, as he turns and heads south, do you guys know what's happening? This is a critical time. All this building up of the kingdom of heaven, the ideas of the kingdom of heaven, all this Jesus being the answer to the Jewish problems, being the Messiah. Once he turns south, he's headed for his crucifixion. The resistance is going to increase. There's no more middle ground for people having to decide whether they're going to follow Jesus or not. They have to be for him or against him. When he turns south, he knows what the movement south means. He knows the cost. The disciples have no idea. To them right now, everything's still good. People are being helped. They still believe the kingdom of heaven is going to be on earth, and it'll include them in high positions of power. He'll restore the nation of Israel to prominence over its neighbors. But as I studied the chapter this week, and I read it several times, it made me sad. It made me sad that God's gift of his own son is moving toward his death. The Messiah that Israel had waited for, they didn't recognize. The religious leaders would actually seek the death of not only a good man, if they thought he was just a man, but God's incarnate son, the provision for their sin. I don't like to over apply or over spiritualize, but my mind went to the people I have known and how they have dealt with Jesus. If you remember early when we started the book of Matthew, one of the things I said, the question is, what will you do with Jesus? And that's always been the issue. When you're told the truth about Jesus, you have a decision to make, either for or against him. The Jews had that same decision, and so do the people we know. You have a chance, a time to make the choice, and then your choice takes over your decisions and your actions. We touched on that just briefly last week. I was given the book Unbroken, if you guys have read that book. I haven't seen the movie, although somebody gave me a copy of it this morning, so I might watch it. I don't like brutality, though, so I'm not sure I can handle that. But the best part of the movie, or the best part of the book, the best part of the story is that after he's gone through all that, he is faced with a decision what to do with Jesus. His wife gets saved and takes him to a Billy Graham crusade, and he gets up to leave. He leaves the first day. He comes back, or he gets up to leave, but he doesn't leave. He goes forward instead. And see, therein lies the challenge for all of us, of all of our friends. We're presented with the truth about Jesus. You have a choice to either accept him or reject him. This is a critical point in Matthew because it's all going to change. Everything now is much more, the risks are high. The time for casual consideration of Jesus is gone. You'll be forced to choose. We see Jesus move, skirt the Sea of Galilee to heal the multitudes. Matthew doesn't tell us which direction he went around the Sea of Galilee, but Mark does. In Mark 7:31, it says, "Again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon," and remember that's where he just was, "he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee." Now, the next thing I'm going to tell you is probably, do you guys ever just imagine things? Do you remember last week I said that the area where this Syrophoenician woman came and asked him for a special favor was the area that the prophet had fled to? Elijah, thank you. I only want to say is Elisha, and I know that name. Elijah fled to. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if part of this woman's faith in the God of Israel was left over from something that Elijah taught in that area while he was there for all those months or days or however long that time was when he stayed with that lady. Do you guys ever think those kind of thoughts? I'm just wondering, how did she have such strong faith in God to make that a stronger faith, a stronger belief, certainly than the scribes and Pharisees, and seemed like stronger than the disciples themselves? I probably don't think I can prove in the text that they knew each other, but I'll just imagine for my own mindset. When he comes back, he goes around the north side of the Sea of Galilee, and he comes down the east side. So, and that area is called Decapolis, and Decapolis is an area of 10 cities, since the name, and most of these cities are Gentile cities. So when he's coming down and he's healing the lame, the blind, the mute, the maimed, and others, and I find that interesting, when I try to look up the difference between lame and maimed, it seemed to indicate that the lame were those who had limps and things like that, but maimed were those who were possibly missing appendages or didn't work at all. Whatever the limits were, Jesus definitely healed many. And if you notice, he's coming down the east side of the Sea of Galilee, means that many of the people that are coming to him are Gentiles. So he didn't just start with the one woman that was a Gentile. Now he is here healing many of the Gentiles. And it's also emphasized in the verse just before our sheet takes over when it says they glorified the God of Israel. It doesn't say they glorified their God. It says they glorified the God of Israel. These people came, and I don't doubt that word of what this woman, what Jesus had done for this woman got around. And Jesus won't just heal the Jews. He will heal everybody. You guys spend a lot of time reading the Talmud? Anybody? Okay. Because I had a friend visit this week, we were reading the Talmud together, you know. I just, They kind of have a double standard in the Talmud and in much of Jewish law. There's one rule for the Jews, and that's pretty cool. And there's one rule for the Gentiles, and that's not so cool. For instance, if something bad happens, the Gentile or the Jew might get 10 days in jail, and the Jew would get, the Jew would get 10 days in the jail, and the Gentile would get like a year. And this doesn't exactly breed, you know, a real welcome in this culture. So they were used to being treated as second-class people by the Jews, at least in their culture. But Jesus doesn't do that. It says they glorified the God of Israel. So we can see that he's reaching out. And that if the disciples are watching, this means that all those people who all of their lives have been told were unclean are now acceptable to Jesus. They're acceptable to the kingdom of heaven. He purposely moved through Gentile territory and healed them without questions. You think this will go over real well with the scribes and Pharisees? No, they don't really like that. They don't have compassion for others. They just have compassion for their own national socioeconomic group. And then we come to verse 32, which is at the top of your page. Now Jesus called his disciples to himself and said, I have compassion on the multitude. And he's talking about these same people. See, before when it was the feeding of the 5,000, we're talking Jewish people here. But now we're talking about a much more mixed group. They've been with me 3 days and have had nothing to eat, and I do not want to send them away hungry lest they faint on the way. And his disciples said to him, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to fill such a great multitude? Now, some people have tried to say, if you look into certain forms of higher criticism, that these are just actually two of the same group. You know, just he got a little confused and told the story differently twice. But it's really clear that it's two different groups, two different places, two different times. And especially to note is two different groups of people. He is showing his power to the Gentile as well as to the Jews. And when they say to him, where could we get enough bread in the wilderness to fill such a great multitude? We have to ask the question, did the disciples just forget what happened, you know, a few days or weeks or whatever it was before? Probably not, but Jesus didn't always feed everybody, so they're probably waiting upon him to see. They may think because these are a lot of Gentiles that, and after what he just said, that he's not necessarily going to care for Gentiles in the same manner. It doesn't really say what they thought or why they asked the question. It's clear that he doesn't feed them that way every day, otherwise they would probably not ask the question at all. So he gives thanks in verse 34. We'll just read it. He says, Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, seven and a few little fish. So he commanded the multitude to sit on the ground. And he took the seven loaves and the fish and gave thanks and broke them and gave them to his disciples. And the disciples gave to the multitude. So they all ate and were filled. And they took up seven large baskets full of fragments that were left. Now those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. And then he sent the multitude away, got into the boat, and came into the region of Magdala. So we see him show an incredible show of power with no favoritism broadly to a wide scope of people. And then look what happens next in chapter. We start in chapter 16. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and tested him and asked if he would show them a sign from heaven. First of all, Magdala, the last word in chapter 15, is on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So he's going from the east side back to the west side, where all the Jewish people hang out in greater numbers. And if you remember, just a little bit ago, earlier, when they came to test him, the very first verse in chapter 15 says, the scribes and Pharisees who are from Jerusalem came to Jesus. Does it say the scribes and Pharisees here? Nope. It says the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, this is an unlikely marriage of people. These two groups do not like each other. They vie for power. The Sadducees in this area are Galilean Herodian Sadducees, which means they have bought into the political power structure of the day. They are in line with Herod. which does not put them in good standing with the Pharisees. So to see the Pharisees and Sadducees come together to question Jesus, you have to realize that things are getting to a critical point in the power system of Israel. They are seriously worried about this man, Jesus, who is doing these incredible things that they can't do. So these unlikely allies come together. And you see this in political situations, not so much in our country, but especially in Great Britain, where you have lots of political groups. They'll get together to get a majority so they can rule government, so they can make things happen. So this is not unheard of, but it's especially unlikely when their religious views are different. Remember, the Sadducees don't even believe in eternity. They believe that when you die, it's over. And the Pharisees, so naturally they're the rich ones, because it tends to be, if you're rich and you've lived your life total for yourself, you kind of don't want there to be an eternity because you think you might suffer because you didn't choose wisely to help people. So you just say there isn't, and then you keep all your resources to yourself. Whereas the Pharisees, they tended to be more, well, it doesn't really matter what this life is. We'll set aside, we'll be careful to be ready for the next life. So you can obviously see these two groups' mindsets are not going to be all that equal when it comes to dealing with spiritual decisions. They came to him in verse 1 of chapter 16, and they asked him if he would show them a sign from heaven. Now, this is an interesting phrase. What does from heaven mean? Because they've had all these signs that have been shown. I mean, they've seen all this people healed and heard all these rumors, and you know, what exactly do they want? At that time, the Pharisees and Sadducees believed that signs of healing could be done by demons or by God. So you couldn't be sure the source of the supernatural occurrence if it was just those. But a sign from heaven could only be done or authorized by God. And if you look into the past, you'll remember that there were certain of their very valued prophets had given them signs from heaven. In 1 Samuel 12:18, Samuel brings thunder and rain from a clear blue sky. In 1 Kings 18:38, Elijah brings fire from heaven. In Isaiah 38:8, they make the sundial go back several degrees. This is the kind of sign that they are asking him to do. Something from the heavens that will decide for them once and for all that he is the Messiah. Now remember, they don't long for him to be the Messiah so they can worship him. They are just absolutely terrified of losing their power base, their positions of authority. And if he was powerful, the only thing they want his power for is to establish an earthly kingdom, to give them even more power. They ask for this very highest sign from him because they do not believe he can give it. But we know that he could. In fact, wasn't there a time when he actually did give it? If you think of his death, when he died, the sky went dark from the sixth to the ninth hour. The earth quaked and the rocks were split. So the signs that they wanted actually did come, just not when they wanted them. But when they came at his death, were they more likely to follow him? Did they decide that we were wrong? But remember, there was the person who said, surely this was the Son of God. There were those who recognized those signs as confirming that he was truly the Messiah. But if you don't want to recognize him as the Messiah, you're certainly not going to look for those things. And he answered to them and said, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the colors, the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, but no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed. So here you have the most spiritually discerning, knowledgeable people of the culture with a choice, who should have had the discernment to see all of the things that Jesus did from the beginning with John the Baptist to the end, and they missed them all. And not only did they miss them all, they became brutal against them all. And then he says, a wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign. Because see, they didn't seek the sign so they could follow Jesus, so they could introduce the kingdom of heaven to the world, to reunite God's creation with himself in a tender, gentle way. They wanted that sign, and if he was, then they would have for sure have the power to thrash their local neighbors. But he said, you're not going to get a sign. I'm not going to do what you want. The only sign you'll get is the sign of the prophet Jonah. And if you remember, that sign is that he was buried, swallowed, Jonah gone, and then after 3 days came back to life. And that's the sign that they would get. And we know that for some it is the sign, because we remember when Peter teaches the gospel shortly after the resurrection, many people are converted. If it was all fake, all those people wouldn't have chosen Jesus at that time. They would have taken off and stayed away. Eventually they did see the sign. Many did, but many didn't. And many did, but didn't want to acknowledge it. Because there's always a cost for following Jesus. There's always a certain brutality of culture against you if you become a true Jesus follower. Many of you have sensed that, but in our culture, we don't sense it very much. We haven't had any floggings, or nobody's in the stocks in the village square, or no one gets burned at the stake lately, which is really nice. Our forefathers helped to create a system where we, at least for a while, have protection against that. But see, in this culture, religion and government were mixed, and it all became pretty brutal when you were on the outside of the power base that was there. I don't like to apply too much to us, but we have to be really careful. Each of you have a bit of truth, and with your truth, you have a bit of power. And how are you going to wield that power and that truth? We see churches do brutal things to groups. We see churches go picket something that has to do with the homosexual, gay, or lesbian community. We see churches pick on each other. I don't think that's why God gives us truth. He gives us truth to show love to each other. And if you really have an intimate relationship with God and you really know God, I don't think you've got a lot of power to thrash on other people. For me, the closer I know God, the more I just say, Lord, I am just not a good person. Save me from myself. And I just tend to, I'm human, so I'm, I don't know if I can use this word with you guys. I'm a jerk, okay? I mean, I have my jerk moments. Everybody was complaining about Cam Newton being a poor sport at the end of the Super Bowl, right? I told Val, I can't condemn the guy. I've been a worse sport than that at a card game, you know, or something. You guys laugh. You've never done this, right? Your flesh never came out in any event or competition or anything. I remember the first time I played, this was with you. It wasn't him. I'm not using him as the example, but it was at a church league basketball back in like 77 or something. And I remember this dude, he got a foul and he double flips off the ref in a Christian church league. And I'm like, okay, there's a little flesh sin nature still out in the believers out there, right? I mean, he prayed about it first, so it was okay, right? You see, when he gives us power, when he gives us truth, and truth helps us to understand, helps us to steer clear sometimes of the real stupidity which draws us in, it's meant for us to be kind. It's meant, as it was given to the nation of Israel, they were given truth to share and to love other people with, not to be harsh. And we have to make sure that we take our truth and we use it with compassion for those people that we encounter. Because really, we're not all that smart. And I don't think most of us would have a hard time admitting we're not all that good either. And we're just thankful the Lord has really helped us. And he's given us a direction, and he's given us the ability to see through. And why not just share that with other people as we go through our week? Let's pray. Lord, you are so good to us. Help us to learn from your word and not to use the truth that you give us to be harsh, but to be loving and kind to others and to help them and our fellow believers to be more conformed to your image. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.